This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
We're talking about Zen Buddhist practice in a diverse culture with Elihu Genmyo Smith today. Welcome.
Thank you.
Since Elihu and I have known each other and served on various committees and task force over the years, we'll use our first names. But tell me about your various names. Elihu Genmyo Smith.
Well,
Smith is as common as can be, but tell me about the first two.
Well, Elihu is the name I was given at birth. It's a family name. My grandfather's name was Elihu, and so I was given that. He had died, and in my family, the tradition was to give names of people who had died to children, grandchildren. So actually, I had three cousins, all who had the same name, Elihu, and often, if we were together, we had to differentiate big Elihu, little Elihu, middle Elihu.
And where did you grow up?
In New York City.
And tell me about the middle name, Genmyo. G-E-N-M-Y-O.
Genmyo. Genmyo is one of two names I received when I when I took the precepts. In the Buddhist tradition, receiving the precepts is often accompanied by being given a name by one's teacher or the person officiating. So Genmyo is one of the two names, and it's the name that's used regularly. It's it's written with Chinese characters, and Genmyo is the Japanese way of pronouncing it. The Chinese way of pronouncing it would be Xuan Miao, excuse my poor Chinese. And it essentially means, Gen means mysterious or dark, and Myo means subtle or mysterious as well. So it's mysterious, subtle, or if you want to put a somewhat different twist on it, you could just say shady character.
Now, mysterious, I'll let our radio listeners know you're wearing all black. Is that part of that mysteriousness?
Actually, Gen has a sense of black or dark, but the mysterious is in the sense of the nature of reality, that there is a sense of it that's beyond what we know or the limits of what we can know. Now, the wearing black is in part as ordained in the Zen tradition, we often wear black clothes, robes, and I feel comfortable in it. So these pants are the pants that I wear in more informal occasions, whereas in more formal occasions I would wear full robes. But I don't do that most of the time here.
And you've just come from a retreat, you were telling me. And do the type of clothes you're wearing, which are comfortable and they look like they would stretch, does that help when you're sitting for long times, meditating and teaching?
Well, yes.
Cross-legged on the floor, I suppose.
Yeah. It's important when we do sitting meditation or sitting practice or even other practice, we want to, in a sense, support ourselves in order to be able to do it, because our practice is a bodily practice. So you want to have clothes that you can sit in comfortably. Often the instructions are make sure it's not too tight around the waist, something that you could fold your legs in if you sit in either a cross-legged or a kneeling position, but just so that you could move and not be restricted. In a sense, you could say Zen is a body-mind practice, and therefore how you're dressed is important. Important not because it's, quote, better or worse, but because it's more supportive. In the same sense, you want clothes that are not particularly visually intrusive, whether with loud colors or lots of writing, etc.
That would be distracting.
Yes.
Or possibly.
Yeah.
And I'm wearing a T-shirt that says some university on it. I can't even read it upside down. But so I apologize if I'm distracting.
Oh, no. This is just in the formal setting within a practice hall, within a zendo. It's not a matter of wearing of any rules otherwise. I wear T-shirts with all sorts of loud, outrageous sayings.
Now tell us what a zendo is.
A zendo, do means a place where one practices the way. So you have a zendo means a place where one practices Zen. It's often also referred to as a dojo. But you have it in other Japanese martial arts. You have an aikido is a place where, or other dos where one practices the way. And Zen is considered a way with a big W. So it's the way of Zen or the way of Buddha Dharma, Buddha's teaching.
Now, since Taoism, T-A-O-I-S-M, Taoism also talks about the way, how is Zen Buddhism distinguished from Taoism?
Okay. Let me say that Taoism is one of the influences that helped form and is part of the development of Chan, which is what Zen is in China. In China, the word Zen is pronounced as Chan, and that's where the tradition developed and flourished in China in the 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th century, and so forth. So Taoism is one of the influences, and the word the way, the word Tao, is the same word Do, is the word the way, though Taoism is slightly different than Buddha Dharma, Buddhist way. There are differences, there are overlaps, and there's differences.
We're talking today on Keeping the Faith with Sensei Elihu Genyo Smith, who is the director of the Prairie Zen Center in Champaign, Illinois, Champaign-Urbana, and we're eager to have people who are listening call in with questions or comments. The way to do that is if you are in Champaign-Urbana, do punch in your phone 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Elsewhere, you may call us toll-free. If it's a long-distance call, use 1-800-222-9455. So long distance, even if you're listening on a computer somewhere on the web, do call us, 1-800-222-WILL. Elihu, I used the word sensei. Tell us what that is.
Sensei means teacher, and it's an honorific used in Japanese tradition. It's used both for school teachers, for teachers of various arts, various traditions, and also in the religious tradition. So Zen is one of a number of traditions where a teacher would be referred to in an honorific manner as sensei. We don't use it very much just because it's Japanese. And as much as possible, it's important for people to see that Zen practice, even though it comes from Japan, is about being human, and it's about what we as humans are, rather than a particularly exotic form of a tradition that's about becoming like Japanese. Even though we have a lot of forms and words that we use, either Japanese or Chinese or even Indian, because there is no equivalent, or because they're supportive of practice, supportive of accomplishing the way.
Now, you've talked about Zen Buddhist practice several times, and you've talked about it being a bodily practice, a mind-body practice. Can one be a Christian and do Zen Buddhist practice? Can one be a Jew and do Zen Buddhist practice? Is this something that or does it have to be, is it something exclusive that one makes a choice and is only?
No. Let me start from the top down.
Sure.
I have in as what we call Dharma relatives, in other words, people who are in lineages connected to me, even very close, who are Christian priests or Catholic priests, I should say, who are Zen teachers, Catholic nuns who are certified, in other words, they receive transmission or authorization to be Zen teachers, Jewish rabbi received authorization. So that's just a few examples. I know Jesuit priests who are Zen teachers. So, in fact, there are a number of Zen training centers that are both Christian and have times when they do Christian Zen and times when they do Buddhist Zen.
Hmm.
So, no, it's not an either-or, at least not from the Zen point of view. I can't speak for Christians or Orthodox Jews or any other tradition. But
or Muslims.
But from the Zen practice point of view, the practice has to do with a practice that's accessible to anyone, and anyone that's human can practice. It doesn't matter what tradition one comes from. The content of the practice tends, of course, to reflect its Buddhist tradition and is an expression of the Buddha's teaching. But if someone else wants to include that Christian tradition, no problem.
We have a caller waiting on line one. You're on Keeping the Faith with our guest, Elihu Genmyo-Smith. Go ahead.
Hello. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about ritual, so to speak, or maybe you would call it something different in Zen Buddhism, like chanting or slow walking meditation or bowing or bells used at certain points in the practice. To explain more how that's supportive.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let me start by saying the forms, which is what you're talking about, you call them rituals, the forms of the practice are intended to enable one to be present, to support someone in being present. So there's various forms of activities, whether sitting still, which supports you both in being present and in also seeing the ways that the habits of body-mind, as I like to say, in which keep us from being present, which within which we get caught up and miss our life. So among the forms that are traditional are chanting, are walking slowly or walking fast. Some Zen traditions have fast walking, some have slow walking, and some have slow and fast walking. So it's not an either or. It's in the movement there's practice. In the stillness, there's practice. In listening to bells and simply being chanting, in giving oneself over to the chanting, there's practice. And also in the words, in a sense, in imbibing the words and the content. So little by little, if you chant, let's say, the Heart Sutra, you start hearing phrases, form is emptiness, emptiness is form, and so on. Now, it's not a matter of trying to understand them right away, but little by little, these start to percolate in us. And there's something in that that maybe clarifies a little bit the nature of our life, the nature of how we see form, or how we bump up against the forms of our life.
Let me interrupt just a moment to ask the caller, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Have you practiced some of these forms or rituals yourself?
Actually.
Uh-huh. Have you found some that are more helpful than others for you?
I guess I find them all helpful. It's just that I had used the word ritual once, and I think forms is maybe a better word. And this had really put someone off when they heard the word ritual, although I think we all have rituals in our lives. So that was part of it. And I'd be interested to hear the rest of what Elihu has to say, but I'll just intervene with one more question about bowing. Do you think that the bowing that one does in Zen practice is the same as, you know, people in Japan do in social practice, or is there something different about that bowing?
I think there's something, well, let me say, I won't speak about what people do in social practice in Japan. Let me leave that aside.
Okay.
But let me say something about bowing in Zen or Buddhist tradition. Because bowing, if I could wait a second on bowing, I just want to finish what I was going to say about bells, and then I'll get to bowing. Because bells, and not only bells, but clappers and wooden mallet sounds and various other sounds in Zen traditional forms have two aspects. One is there's a training aspect in all this in the sense of the our ability to do those functions, to hit the bells, to hit the, in a way that more and more we allow the bell to hit the bell. We give ourselves over to that. And in a way, we, if we say what practice is about, it's about forgetting the self. And those forms enable us to do that. But there's another aspect for those of us hearing and responding to bells. We respond in a way that's somewhat, if I say it, deeper. It's really not deeper or more shallow, but deeper than just on the conceptual, intellectual level. But there's a response that it draws out of us. So that's part of the value of all the various forms, or some of the forms. There's a lot more that can be said about the forms. But let me say about bowing, because bowing is a form. It's a form of body-mind practice. It's a form of giving the self away to the bowing. It's a form of expressing something with the whole body, not dependent necessarily on whether we mentally have figured something out, whether we thought it out and are consciously thinking of something, but of in the sense of doing which includes whatever mental conscious thinking is there, but it's a doing practice. And it's a practice in which the practice gives us something in the doing, reveals something, and that's a sense I mean gives us. So, and there's intention. We bow with circumstances, with certain intentions. We bow towards certain images sometimes. We bow towards life itself. So there's a practice aspect that bowing, and it enables us to bump up against all sorts of resistance as well, all sorts of ideas we have, all sorts of reasons we don't want to bow or we shouldn't have to bow. I'll go a step further. If you think of animals, gorillas, various other forms of chimpanzees, monkeys, and even animals like dogs, you'll see that they have forms similar to bowing, where they do that sort of activity when they express certain things. So,
bowing to another person, then, would you say that's similar to the Indian idea of namaste, to bow to yourself and the other person?
I wouldn't say it's bowing to yourself. You're bowing to the who that person truly is. When you say namaste, so it's not yourself, because yourself is a small. It's you're bowing, if you want to use in the Indian tradition, you're bowing to the nature of the life that the other person is manifesting right here.
Perhaps a larger self.
If you want to use that word, but we need to be careful, because we often then create a picture of a larger self as opposed to a smaller self. Mm. But you could say larger self, but still, as long as you have the caveat I just mentioned.
Mm-hmm. And then finally, just let me come back to the word training that you used. You said people were training to ring the bells properly or with the right rhythm.
I don't mean with the right rhythm or properly, but in the sense that training of we start to discover our own activities and our own, what should I say, resistance or our own habits or our own intrusion in the activity?
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess I'm just wanting to ask whether, I mean, just if you think that the word conditioning is completely out of place in talking about Zen, or, you know, like that, for example, these rituals, whether they be chanting or slow walk or or bowing or hearing bells, in some sense they might trigger a previous response that you had developed in a previous, like, meditation period. Do you reject that as not being in the present, or can that happen?
No. I'm not quite sure where you're going, so let me say something, and if you want to follow up, fine. I mean, in a sense, anything we are learning, there's a certain amount of conditioning, developing of skills.
Mm-hmm.
And then the more we become skilled at it, the more we can go beyond the skills if we truly see how to do that, if we intend to do that, so that we could forget the skills and allow the skill to function as our action rather than us doing the skill. In the beginning, there's a lot of tension, a lot of trying to do it right. And then little by little, it's the same with all sorts of other activities. And certainly with people who master skills, at a certain point, they throw away their mastery and then the mastery starts functioning, or then the skill truly starts functioning.
And then is there also the danger of you know, sort of taking things for granted and not being present because you know?
Mm-hmm. There's always danger, and the danger is not of not being present, but the danger, I mean, you could say it that way, but I would say the danger is always of self-centeredness intruding. Self-centeredness is often that we're caught up in a small aspect of our functioning, mm-hmm. a small aspect of our emotion, thought, and we miss our life. We're mm-hmm. caught up and attached. And that's not being present, even though we think it's being present.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I just wanted some clarity on that. And maybe the use of the word forms is less off-putting than the word ritual, since it has so many different significations.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much for the
thank
call.
You.
Appreciate
okay,
thank
it.
Thank you.
Let me repeat the phone numbers for other listeners who might like to ask a question or make a comment in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We'll put you on the air with our guest, Eliu Genmyo-Smith, talking about Zen Buddhist practice in a diverse culture. If it's a long-distance call, use the 800 number 222-9455. WILL is the call letter of the station, of course, that corresponds with 9455, if that helps you remember. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for this program, and today we're talking about one of the Zen Buddhism, which is comes from the East. And I need to, I suppose, just explain that my questions are from someone trained in Western philosophy and thought and religion and culture, and so I may not even be asking the right kind of questions. I'm not sure what questions about Zen Buddhism would be asked from an Eastern perspective, but I'll admit my cultural bias right from the start. For example, I get confused, Eliu, when you say things like, let the bell hit the bell, forget the self, give the self away to the bowing. I don't know what that means.
Well, the more I explain it, the further away it goes. But let me start by this way. In Buddhist tradition, we might say that what creates difficulties is a self-centered way of functioning. We could call it attachments. We could call it delusion. We could call it beliefs of separation, a dualistic separation of self versus the universe, self versus others. Let me say, this weekend I was talking about freedom in the talks at the retreat, at the Sesshin, as we call it. Sesshin means unified mind or collect. What freedom, in a sense, is another word for Zen practice. Freedom meaning being who we truly are, as opposed to being who we think we are, or the habits of body-mind that we usually function as. See, often in the West, when we think of the word freedom, we think of freedom from something, or freedom to something, or freedom of something. And I would say the word freedom, or to liberation, or saving, or beings, all those words exist in translations of Buddhist texts, and the emphasis is liberation from this attachment and delusion that blinds us to who we really are, or the ideas and beliefs, if I say it in simple terms, that keep us from functioning and relating. Ideas meaning, I want it my way. Reacting because my expectation wasn't met. See, that's the sense of self. Now, this isn't just conscious. It's not just the conscious level of emotion, thoughts, but it's also in our whole body functioning. So part of Zen practice or Zen training is to start being bigger than that, if I use that kind of, being a bigger container than the smaller self-centered way that we walk around and function and relate. So if we want to talk about forgetting the self, I mean, there's a famous part of a longer poem by Zen master Dogen, which goes, to study the Buddha way is to study, or to practice the Buddha way is to practice the self, to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be enlightened or awakened by all phenomena that we encounter. And this enlightenment goes on. So it's that sort of sense. Now, saying that is one thing. Clarifying that, in a sense, is our lifetime practice, our lifetime effort. And I use the word practice in the sense that Buddhist tradition is a tradition of praxis, with P-R-A-X-I-S. I think that's the correct spelling. In the sense, it's a doing. And in this exists in the West as well. I mean, you could think of Christian tradition. Some Christian traditions talk about living a life as Christ lived, living the life of Christ. Now, that's a doing life. It's not a matter of believing A, B, C, even though that's important in Christian tradition, whereas in Buddhist tradition, it's seen in a different way. But it's about how one lives, and in living, one manifests what one discovers. And that's the important thing.
Do Buddhists need to believe any sort of a creed, any sort of a set of beliefs? Do they need to believe anything about, for example, Buddha?
Well, let me – need is a funny word. In Buddhist tradition, there is the tradition of what we call taking refuge in Buddha, taking refuge in the Dharma, meaning the teaching, taking refuge in the Sangha, which is the community of practitioners. There's also the aspect where there's a certain amount of faith in the teaching, but the faith has to do that if one does this, then one can accomplish the way. What the Buddha says at the end of his life is he says, you all know what to do now. I'm paraphrasing. Now work hard, endeavor to accomplish the way by practicing this. See, so that's the important part. Now, there are beliefs of all sorts. In fact, in the fall, I'm going to teach a class called Eight Beliefs of Buddhism. But I would be, you know, the problem is with the word beliefs, it's not something we have to hold on to. In fact, it's just the opposite. In Buddhism, or at least in Zen tradition, any belief that you hold on to, you have to get rid of. Mm-hmm. We have an expression, from the top of the 100-foot pole, meaning whatever you've accomplished, take a step further. So if you have beliefs, they blind you. Even gold, when in the eye, it's blinding.
Now, wouldn't that be a problem for monotheists, whether Islam or Judaism or Christianity?
Well, Buddhism is a non-theistic tradition.
Right.
So there is no God in the sense that, or there is no creator, you know, omnipotent force in the sense that monotheistic or theistic traditions have it. Mm-hmm. There are all sorts of gods talked about in various Buddhist traditions, but that's seen in a different way. That's seen as one of the realms of existence.
Mm-hmm. We're talking today on Keeping the Faith with our guest, Sensei Elihu Genmyo Smith, who is the director of the Prairie Zen Center in Champaign, Illinois. If folks are interested in learning more about this, we'll be asking him more questions for the last half of the program in just a moment. But if you can't hear all that, do check out their website, www.prairiezen.org. Prairie Zen is all pushed together in one word. PrairieZen.org is their website. There's also a newsletter of the Prairie Zen Center called Prairie Sky. And I noticed the one from last month that Elihu loaned me has a Dharma talk teaching that he wrote is part of it, and it also tells about his schedule in terms of where he'll be teaching and speaking around the Midwest in the next couple months. There's also an email that people can contact the Prairie Zen Center, and that's pzc@prairiezen.org. And let's see, Smith is spelled the obvious way, Elihu is E-L-I-H-U, Genmyo is G-E-N-M-Y-O. We'll be getting back to our guest in just a moment. Let me mention who some of the guests coming up on Keeping the Faith will be. Next week, we're repeating a program that's been requested, a discussion about evolution and religion by a science professor at the University of Illinois, Professor Bruce Falk. This was broadcast originally in March, and we've had several requests to have it replayed. So that'll be next Sunday, July 24. Coming up July 31, we'll be talking with Pastor Roger Diggs from Grace Lutheran Church about God and the Ivory-billed Woodpecker. That should be an interesting program. That's July 31. August 7, we'll be talking with folks from the Crisis Nursery. Later in August, people from the Interfaith Alliance. In September, with a philosopher and historian of religion about callings, 20 centuries of Christian wisdom on vocation. That'll be Professor Bill Plaker from Wabash College. Those are some of the programs coming up on Keeping the Faith. Keeping the Faith programs are supported in part by the University YMCA at the University of Illinois. The Y has been helping develop student leaders since 1873 by providing opportunities for social action and community service, for working on issues of the environment, for tutoring in the public schools, doing service projects over spring breaks, all sorts of things. We have a wonderful building on Wright Street, right across from Lincoln Hall, that we've been using since 1937. The larger Y building was sold to the university earlier. It's now called Illini Hall, also on Wright Street. But the Y has been up and down Wright Street for well over a century and providing various service projects. One of our projects that's been very popular the last 3 years is called Dump and Run, where we encourage students, instead of throwing accumulated possessions away when they leave school for the summer or when they graduate, to donate them to the Y. And we have a huge garage sale, the largest in the community, every fall. It'll be coming up the first week of school, the last week of August. And we'll be using the University Stock Pavilion. And all kinds of graduate students coming from other countries and people in the community come and buy some wonderful bargains on that day. People in the community also contribute to this. Right now, we're not accepting items during this part of July except furniture. Well, furniture and bicycles. Well, furniture and bicycles and vehicles, like cars and trucks and vans and motorcycles and boats and trailers, things like that. We can take all those now. But we're not taking clothes, we're not taking household items, we're not taking kitchen goods, because we just don't have room to store them because of some of our other university classes that are going on at the Y right now. However, starting in August, for a week or two, we will accept all those things if people have leftovers from their own garage sales or things from their attics that they want to clear out and would like to donate. All these things you donate to the Y can be listed as a charitable donation, including automobiles, and we're happy to give you receipts for those. So if you're interested in finding out more about that, do call me, Steve Shoemaker. I'm the director at the Y, 337-1500, or Rachel Dekas, who's in charge of our dump and run operation. Well, let's get back to our guest today. We're having a good time talking about Zen Buddhism. We have a caller waiting on line one with a comment or question. Go right ahead. Elihu is listening.
Hello.
Yes.
Elihu, would you say a few words about the role of a teacher in Zen and also the role of a center such as the Prairie Zen Center?
Thank you very much. Appreciate the question.
In a sense, the word teacher is a funny word to use in Zen tradition. Because though I do give talks, and in that sense, and I do at times hold classes in which I'm definitely function as a teacher, but in another sense, my role is to not to give any specific words or ideas, but to encourage and support the practice of others, to teach how to do the practice, but then to, in a way, push, to test, to challenge.
To get out of the way, right?
To get out of the way. In some ways, it's to be there for what's appropriate and see what's appropriate and what's needed by this individual and offer it. And then it's up to them to make use of it. And then to, in a sense, to test it and to almost, you could say, certify the extent of their clarity, to see what they're doing. So in that sense, that's part of my role. And the form that supports that activity, both mine activity and activity of others who want to practice, is a Zen center, a place where we come together to sit during the week at various times, sometimes for as longer periods, several days of sitting or even a week of sitting, and have an ongoing practice and an ongoing relationship. And practice is not only in terms of myself and one individual, but it's all of the people that practice together. We have the term Sangha, which means the group of people practicing together. Originally, it meant just the monks or nuns, but it's used in a much broader sense to mean all people who practice together. So sitting with others supports you in sitting. Some of it is very straightforward in the fact that it's structured and it's easier to start and end a period and to go through the difficulties of sitting still for 30 minutes, even though you want to move. Mm-hmm. But there's also something much deeper, that a support that it develops because you and others are sitting silently together. You and others are working together, walking together, eating together, reading, chanting together. So there's a supportive aspect of that. My function in that is, in a sense, to keep the forms going, to tweak it in different ways so that it could be most useful. Being supportive sometimes means having to sort of stop things, cut things off, change, challenge, confuse, all sorts of ways in which I function. In the Zen tradition, we are often, if you look at the Japanese or the Chinese model, there's a certain amount that's a little rougher than the way, at least the way we practice in America. There's a lot of hitting and shouting, but we don't do too much of that. But that's a very integral part of the tradition. And one of the, figures, bodhisattvas in the tradition, is the figure of wisdom who has a sword cutting through delusion in order to expose, to reveal the wisdom of life.
Now, the caller also asked about the function of a center like the Prairie Zen Center. Now, yours is located at 515 South Prospect in Champaign. Mm-hmm. You have a schedule of various activities. Mm-hmm. On Sunday morning, typically you have a service at 9, you have an orientation at 10, you have a Dharma talk, a teaching at 11. Mm-hmm. Is that open to the public?
Yeah. The Zen Center is open to anyone who wishes to come. The best time to come, if you're new to it, is that 10 o'clock orientation on Sunday mornings, if you arrive a few minutes before 10. Anyone can sit, but it's difficult. Therefore, it's best to go through an orientation to learn to do it.
Now, how many people typically are there?
Could be 10, could be... Our capacity is 30. Uh-huh. So we're a small group.
Small group.
There are much larger Zen centers in Chicago. There's probably 5 or 10 Zen centers in Chicago area.
Now, with that small of a group, you as the director probably can't make a living by what they pay you.
No, it's
so you have another job.
At this point in my life, I don't have another job. I'm partially house husband, uh-huh. and partially I spend the rest of my time at the Zen Center. In the past, I've worked and done this, but at the present moment, not. But sometimes I've taught at the university. I also worked as a forensic clinician, and I have a LCSW certification. I have lots of different, academic training in different forms, and I've done lots of work of...
Different sorts.
Yes.
Okay. So this has been an avocation?
No.
Well,
this has been a vocation, which at various times I've had to do additional vocations in order to earn a living.
Sure.
But I've been doing this, I've been practicing since 71. I've been practicing formally in the Zen tradition since 74. I was ordained in 79. Now, being ordained doesn't mean one is ready to teach. I was authorized to teach or certified or both independently in 92. I was doing it a little bit before then under the supervision of my teacher then.
Do you charge for your teachings?
It's a church, in a sense, the way we receive donations. It's a nonprofit church. We ask for donations. We ask for a certain donation to attend retreats. We ask for people make membership donations, which help support the building, which help support the functioning. I also travel to Springfield and various other locations and do this.
Is there a board of directors or trustees or something?
Yes, there's a board of directors. It's a, I don't know, remember which section of the IRS codes, 501 something, C.
C3 probably, yeah.
Yes, organization. Okay. There's a board of directors who, in a sense, runs the Zen Center. My function is to run the teaching of the Zen Center.
Does the board hire you or do you select the board?
No, the board is elected by the members.
Ah, okay.
I am the teacher, but my function in terms of the leading is as much focused or primarily focused on the teaching function, if you call it that, or the leading function, the dharma function, the function of the practice as opposed to the administrative function. Now, if it was a larger organization, there's various alternative forms where how that could occur.
Is the Prairie Zen Center locally connected to a larger Zen Buddhist organization or association nationally or internationally?
Let me put it the different way. I am related to larger Buddhist or Zen groups, national, but the organization is not connected legally. It's a standalone. And that's the way it is in the Zen tradition for the most part. But individuals, I have a number of lineages and groups that I'm part of, American Zen Teachers Association, Ordinary Mind Zen School, White Plum Zen Tradition. So,
now, how does Zen Buddhists teach children? Like, you've raised two children, you have a 19-year-old daughter, you have a 12-year-old son.
Well,
do you consciously teach them to be Zen Buddhists, or is this something that must be sought after by individuals?
It really varies. Let me say, it varies according to the size of the center and the nature of the people who participate. So in some areas, not here, because we don't have many people with children participating. So we don't really have a function of teaching children, though my son identifies himself as a Buddhist and he's asked me to teach him to do meditation. He's young. Since he's 12, I've taught him, but there isn't really a way for him to participate full time. It's not appropriate. But I have a number of colleagues or peers who have schools. They have Dharma schools, as they call it. They have classes for children. They have functions for children, as in other church or religious traditions. They have, because they have a larger population to draw from and larger number of children. So they have all sorts of activities. They have summer Zen summer camp.
Now, in terms of what happens at a retreat, you just finished this. You said you started this retreat on Thursday.
Thursday night.
It's mainly silence for the people who are there practicing Zen Buddhism. You, as the teacher, do meet them individually, you were telling me. Now, tell me what goes on when you meet someone who is learning.
Well, let me start by saying what they're doing, if I can.
Sure.
And then essentially, we start early in the morning, we start formal sitting, which is formal practice, at 10 minutes to 5 in the morning. And people will be sitting in 30-minute blocks within 10-minute walking periods up till about 7. Then there'll be a period of chanting, a meal done silently with a certain amount of form. Then there's a work period.
What kind of food?
Vegetarian.
Okay.
Simple vegetarian. And cooking and preparing the food is part of the retreat. It's part of the work of the retreat. So it's all done by people in the retreat. Then there's some work, and then there's more sitting.
What kind of work?
Work, weeding, gardening, painting, cleaning, chopping vegetables, cooking food, some people typing transcripts, etc. I give, during this time, and this continues throughout the day, usually I'll do one formal talk where I talk about practice. I'll bring up a text, a traditional text, and then express Zen understanding with it and use it not so much to teach concepts, but to challenge, encourage, and clarify practice and use it as a way of encouraging people to practice. And in the same, when people come in to meet me face to face, what we do is we explore practice together. Sometimes we could do it silently. Sometimes we could do it with words. Sometimes we could do it with actions. It depends on their practice, because what they come in is present where they are, what their practice is, and whatever's up for them, so to speak, about how whether they're sitting or whether other themes. Sometimes they have a formal practice called koan practice, and then we work on that.
K-O-A-N.
K-O-A-N, which in means essentially, well, it's a case. It means a public case. And there are many hundreds of public cases in the Chan and Zen tradition. And some of them are used as practice themes, as meditation themes, if I use that word.
We're down to our last 10 minutes on this Keeping the Faith program. Our guest is Elihu Genmyo Smith, director of the Prairie Zen Center in Champaign. My name is Steve Shoemaker. Let me encourage listeners during our last 10 minutes, if you'd like to make a call, 333-9455 is the number in Champaign-Urbana. That's 333-WILL. Elsewhere, you may call us toll-free, including, if you're listening on the Internet, 1-800-222-9455. Elihu, let me give you a case. This last week, several tragedies around the world.
Mm-hmm.
Pakistan train wreck, 300 killed. Bombing in London, 30 or 40 killed, many injured. You're having a retreat in the Midwest with Zen Buddhists. Do those events affect what you talk about or think about or meditate on, or are those separate?
They could be a theme. I didn't use them in my talks, but certainly when 9/11 occurred, I used that as a theme for talking about practice. It could also be a theme that people bring up because of their reactions to it, their concerns about it, their fears. And then we talk about how does one work with this, because this is part of our life. Practice is always about our life. It's not about some abstraction somewhere else, but it's about the real day-to-day functioning, whether call it psychological, emotional, physical, relationship, all of that is grist for the mill of practice.
Okay. We have a caller waiting on line one. You're on Keeping the Faith. Go ahead.
Hi. I think Steve's asked you the question I wanted to ask, which was, where does the sense of witness or social commitment to social change or justice fit into the practice of Buddhism? And I'll listen to your answer. Thank you.
Well, in a sense, that's a personal decision, and certain people have proclivities for social, what's sometimes called engaged Buddhism, but really what you're talking about is social activism in a certain way, and some people don't. So the Zen center as a center isn't involved in that as a formal institution, and it's not a proclivity of mine. I'm not I have limited amount of energies and directions of what I could do, and that isn't one of the one that I spend a lot of time with, though I do when it comes up in terms of the individual's functioning. But I want to take it a step further, is that it's important in Zen tradition to see how does one not get caught up in me and them, right and wrong, anger and violence, in whatever sort of activity we're involved in, whether it's social activism, whether it's in taking any political position. See, in a way, you have to be able to sit with Michael Moore on one side of you and George Bush on the other side of you. And if you have problems with that, then right there is something to work with. Buddha nature is evident, exists, functions in everyone you encounter. Everyone you encounter is a bodhisattva. Everyone you encounter is exactly your own life. And yet, you have to see what's appropriate to do with some people and not with others. You have to see, how do I express my disagreement in a way that's appropriate and yet doesn't get me caught up in all sorts of, what should I say, delusions, in all sorts of anger, violence, and all the poisons that poison us, poison our life.
Caller, do you want to follow up on any of that? I think she decided to just listen. Let me ask a follow-up question to that. In terms of what is real, what's the metaphysics of Buddhism?
Let's say it the other way. Buddhism is less, I mean, you could have all sorts of metaphysics, and there's all sorts of texts which are metaphysical. But in the Zen tradition, it's always this hard knocks right here. It's always the here and now. It's always just this present moment. Past is a fiction. Future is a fiction. They're just dreams right now. And in fact, that's what the practice is. The practice is being bodily present, being body-mind present here. And if I would say it another way, opening up any places where we're closing ourselves up around ideas, attachments, beliefs, so that we can be fully present as we are.
But you referred earlier to traditional texts, something from the past that you feel is relevant to the present that you use.
Yes, and it's always about taking those texts and making them alive now. In the Zen tradition, we talk about dead words and live words. Mm. If it's dead words, it's worthless.
What are some traditional Zen Buddhist texts?
There's what's known as sutras, which are teachings of the Buddhas. Then there's collections of koans or collections of, there's one called the Gateless Gate or Mumonkan. Another one is called the Blue Cliff Record, which is a collection of, there's various, what's called wisdom sutras, Heart Sutra, Diamond Cutter Sutra. Those are some of the Buddhist texts, but any teachings of the Buddha are also included in that. And there's various, I could list many, but it would be.
You mentioned earlier when one of the callers asked about different rituals or forms of bowing, and you'd mentioned earlier bowing to an altar. Mm-hmm. What's on the altar, or what does the altar represent?
Well, let let me answer the second question first, because that's better. The altar represents what our life truly is. See, it represents if you want to say, the center of our life or what our life is. Now, traditionally, you often have a Buddha image on the altar as a representation. Often there's a seated Buddha with a certain serenity and stability. Sometimes there's what's known as a bodhisattva or a manifestation of compassion. Sometimes there's Kuan Yin or Avalokiteshvara. Sometimes there's a bodhisattva who manifests wisdom, such as Manjushri. There's all sorts of different forms. But the forms are manifestations of the nature of what our life is. Bodhisattva is someone out there, but is not someone separate from us. So it's not separate. Yet, sometimes it's useful to have a form. Sometimes an altar just has a calligraphy or a rock or a flower. Mm. So it depends. It depends on the circumstance.
What are some of the events coming up in our last minute or so at the Prairie Zen Center that are open to the public?
I would... The best way to explore the Prairie Zen Center is, as I said, come on a Sunday for orientation, for sitting to learn about it. We have regular Sunday sittings that start with chanting and then go and include a Dharma talk. We also have classes in the fall. We'll have a class that's titled Fundamentals of Reality / Fundamentals of Buddha's Teaching, which will be on Tuesday nights, September 13th through the December 13th. And we'll explore various texts which try to deal with issues such as impermanence, change, emptiness, various themes or concepts that have been developed in Buddhist tradition that are important in helping us to clarify what our life is.
Well, thank you very much. We've been talking today with Elihu Genmyo Smith, who is the teacher and director at the Prairie Zen Center in Champaign. We've been talking about Zen Buddhist practice in a very diverse culture that we find ourselves in America. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these programs. Coming up in the next couple weeks here on WILL, on Sunday afternoons at 5 on Keeping the Faith. Next week, we're having an archive program with Bruce Falk, who will be talking about evolution and religion. That's an archive program that was broadcast originally in March. On July 31, we'll be talking with Roger Diggs about God and the Ivory-billed Woodpecker. That should be a very interesting program. We're talking about the Crisis Nursery on August 7th. And later in August, about the Interfaith Alliance with Colleen Vojak and others. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Meat and potatoes isn't just what's for dinner, it's a way of life. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on the Peabody Award-winning program To the Best of Our Knowledge, Food That Sticks to Your Ribs, we'll get into the science of the French fry and celebrate the anniversary of the hamburger. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 here on WILL Urbana.
WILL programming is funded in part by a grant from TK Service Center, 806 Perkins Road in Urbana, offering automotive repair on cars and trucks by ASE-certified technicians. In business since 1984, they perform computerized engine diagnostics, alignments, brake and suspension work, and other repairs. A shuttle service for customers is also available. The phone number for TK Service is 344-0800 or on the web at tkservicecenter.com.
Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, partly cloudy with a low around 70 degrees and south winds around 10 miles per hour during the evening, then becoming light and variable. Tomorrow, partly sunny with a chance of showers and thunderstorms, the high in the lower 90s with southwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with showers and thunderstorms likely during the evening, the low in the upper 60s with west winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. It's 6 p.m. This American Life is next.